The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Hello and welcome. This is the C86 show. I'm David Eastall. As you know, we love a special guest. This week, it's going to be the turn of the photographer Vernon Dewhurst, who I spoke to very recently to find out more about life, love and poetry, and also his life in the creative industries and photography, especially began in the sort of 60s and has had a life in that particular world, and is also very, very well known for his cover photograph of David Bowie's second album, which was released in 1969, which was originally titled David Bowie, but also became known as Space Oddity for obvious reasons. And yes, and also shared a block of flats with David and Hermione during that period. So this is the interview. So after 7 minutes of interesting but casual chat, we get down to that exciting subject that was the very early formative years and any sort of musical or creative awakenings. Anyway, Vernon, it's over to you.
I think it must have been, I guess when I got back from Ireland in the 67. Because I'd gone to Ireland straight after college. I finished college in 66 and then went straight to Dublin and did a year there with my own photographic studio, and got a bit fed up with Dublin because there was too much drinking going on.
Right.
And the girls were all a bit uptight, and we found that I was with a friend, and we found it all a bit not quite the scene for us. So we moved back to London, and luckily we got an arrangement with a studio called Studio 5 in Mayfair, whereby we could work from the studio for free in return for a percentage of the work that we did. Mm. And Studio 5 at the time was really the center of fashion advertising photography in London. There was a lot of really great photographers worked there, including Bailey, Vic Singh, Norman Eales, and we used to get a lot of the top models coming there as well. Yeah. So that was the sort of introduction for me into the world of advertising, fashion photography, and modelling.
Yes.
And, at the same time, I moved in with my girlfriend to a house in Clever Grove, South Kensington, which was where David Bowie was living. I had a room underneath him, and so that was how I met him first of all, and that was where I sort of got more interested in the music scene. Simply yeah. through David.
So just before all that, were your parents at all kind of artistic or had interest in sort of the arts or music or painting or anything like that? Did they have an influence on you?
My dad very much so, because he was a very keen amateur photographer.
Right.
His father before him as well. So he'd have loved to be a photographer, but he was an accountant. And then, when he was brought up, the important thing was to get a good job, a job for life, that was what they were. So unfortunately he got pressured into being an accountant, and but he kept the photography, the amateur side of it, going. I sort of learned photography from him at a very early age.
Yes.
So that was the background.
So can you remember when you got your first camera?
I must have been about 7, 8.
Right.
I remember my dad bought two of them. They were a very simple box camera, one for myself and one for my sister, so she wouldn't get jealous. It was good to learn the fundamentals, you know, and you make your mistakes. And then, of course, he taught me how to develop the film and how to make prints. I used to do that in the bathroom.
Yes, this is the classic. Prints. So when you first got the camera, were you using black and white film at that stage?
Oh, yeah, only black and white, yeah.
So you had to sort of learn about sort of, composition quite a lot and light and shade. So that was the kind of essence, really, wasn't it?
I guess that would come a bit later when I was probably in my teens, and by then I'd got a better camera. My dad bought me, I think, a Model 1 Leica, which was the first 35mm camera, and that really permitted me to get really good quality photographs for the first time. And so then that upped the challenge, if you like. Because the possibility was there to get good quality on the material.
So when you were talking about Dublin, I mean, was this kind of during the sort of mid or even early 60s at that stage when you moved there?
I was there from 66 to 67.
Right. So was that kind of the birth and the kind of beginning of sort of pop culture? Was that something that was on your radar as well with the sort of early, you know, 63 with the Beatles and the Stones and the kind of the British invasion, which was obviously happening in America, not in the UK? But, you know, was that sort of on your radar? Were you in a different world at that stage?
It was a background, I guess. You know, I wasn't, you know, fanatically interested in it. I didn't follow any particular groups more than any others, but you know, like, you know, I used to like the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, and Leonard Cohen, who else, and the usual
fake
groups of the time, without being specifically interested in one over the others.
Yes. So when you went to, you got that house, did you say that was like 67 that you moved into?
67, I was in Dublin.
Right, and then you moved into London sort of soon
back
after
to
that.
London, yeah.
Yes. So when you were there, just as a sort of idea, because I think it was David Bailey was talking about the 60s. This was a documentary I saw many years ago. He was sort of saying, well, actually, it was what we look at, you know, on that level of the swinging 60s and psychedelic 60s. It was only a very small group of people that were really experiencing that. Most of the country were not having the same kind of Technicolor sort of psychedelic experience at all. Was the Summer of Love 67, was that something that was in it, had entered your field, or was that something that was again in a different world?
No, I think that was very definitely part of that period for me. I mean, I went to two of the Hyde Park concerts with the Stones, and I figured who the other one was, might have been,
I think it was King Crimson was one of the support bands, actually, of that.
Yeah, it could be. And so, no, it was very much part of the environment I was living in at the time. You know, a lot of drugs, and the usual sort of stuff you associate with the swinging 60s.
Yes, the kind of, I think in 67 there was the, as I mentioned, the Summer of Love, there was the 14-hour Technicolor Dream at the Ali Pali, where Pink Floyd played and Arthur Brown. So, yes, that it was all happening. I remember doing an interview with Joe Boyd, who did early Pink Floyd and then the Incredible String Band and Nick Drake. And he said that when they, you know, entered, when they left the venue in the morning and seen the sunrise, they thought that it was all, you know, society was going to change forever. He realized that was a bit of a naive thing. So but it's nice to be naive. We look back at that with great fondness, really, and then we get cynical.
And of course, prior to that, when I was still in college in the Regent Street Polytechnic, we had the students' union had the most amazing artists come to play. Like Jimi Hendrix played in the student union. I think the Who came as well. So there was, even while I was at college, you know, an introduction to these big bands.
And, yes, well, that's quite. You were quite lucky there, really, weren't you?
Just very lucky. Quite amazing. I think Jimi Hendrix played with the student union.
Yes, for a few hundred people, you were just just happened to be there in an ambulance.
Yeah, a lot of them probably didn't even know who he was.
The ambivalence of kind of, you know, oh, well, this is fun. But, yeah, so then when you moved into the house, and did you say you were on the top floor or was David on the top floor?
No, David was on the top floor with Hermione, his girlfriend. I was underneath.
Yes.
There was about, I think there was five of us living in the house at the time.
God, that's amazing. So where, how did you sort of then sort of get to work and do that kind of those iconic early shots? Because at this stage, David was very much, he was into the Lindsay Buckingham world, but also Lindsay Kemp world. Sorry, I'm thinking of back there. Lindsay Kemp meets kind of his kind of acoustic period with John Hutchinson, wasn't it? So were you aware of that kind of scene that was going on above you?
Not with David, no, at the time, you know, he was the guy upstairs who was hoping to become a pop singer, you know, and like many others, you know, it was seen at the time that everybody was either wanted to be a pop star or a model or an actor, you know, this was a fairly common thing. But no, David obviously had talent, and, you know, I could see that straight away, but no one could dream he would become, you know, the megastar that he subsequently did.
No. And I always find it kind of interesting, because when I've listened to some of that music from, you know, that he was making at that period and then comparing it to what else was going on, it's kind of even more boggling, really, because it's so out of sync with the zeitgeist, you know, when he's doing these kind of rather quaint and folky songs and, you know, strumming his guitar with his curly hair. And as you mentioned, Jimi Hendrix, and then it was like Jefferson Airplane, The Doors, you know, The Beatles, obviously, et cetera, et cetera, you know. And then you sort of get this kind of rather, you know, Love You to a Tuesday kind of record by David Bowie. It's like, not quite sure we can see the potential there. it's a hard one to imagine. Yeah.
And we don't talk about the Laughing Gnome, of course.
No, when we do, it's even more boggling and baffling. But yeah, so did you? How did you then sort of become kind of acquainted or friends at that time? Even though you're in the same building, doesn't mean you always talk to each other.
No, but we did. It was a very nice group of people there. We all got on very well, and we used to have lots of parties there, of course. And, well, it was sort of natural that, you know, I got to know David. He'd invite me up to his room and play his latest songs and share a glass of wine, have a smoke or whatever.
Yes.
And, you know, just sort of a normal friendship going with him.
Did it feel like quite an innocent sort of romantic kind of vibe that you were getting, just not just in his scene, but just generally? Because it does sound, you know, with the acoustic guitar, Hermione, and just having a nice smoke and a glass of wine.
Yeah, I think it was. But he was Hermione was a lovely girl, very like you say, romantic in a way, very straight, and I think David was very much under the influence of her, and they had. They had a good vibe together.
Yes. Well, it's quite nice. I've, you know, listened to some of the, quite a lot of the material they did, and it's, you know, especially with Hutch, and it's quite sweet at that stage. So did you then get a chance to go to, how did you develop the Beckenham Arts Lab at this stage?
Well, David just asked me if I'd like to go down there and do some pictures. I guess this must have been fairly early on. I don't know how long the Arts Lab was going on for, but I think it was fairly new when I went there, and you know, so I went down once and did a shot a roll of colour of him playing. There was other people there, but I don't know who they were. Looking back on it, so long ago, but
yes. And were you at that stage? Had you left the, you know, the college, you know, degree, whatever you were doing, and were sort of also working on hustling to sort of make it as a photographer yourself at this stage?
Oh, yeah, I've been freelance ever since I left college. So this is 68.
Right.
So I'd been freelance for a year and a half, a couple of years even by then. So,
and were you doing sort of fashion and glamour kind of?
Fashion and advertising.
Right.
But I was still building up my portfolio.
Yes. And were you managing to get yourself kind of a reputation and, you know, a career, a sort of managing to sort of make it happen?
Well, just about, yes. I mean, it was all very, I don't know, it was the sort of beginning for me. So you get by, you know, hope. You don't know, there's no guarantee of success, but you, you know, just do your best.
Yes.
Try and get the best portfolio together you can, and you know, hope that you get work.
Yes, absolutely. So then, so how does this kind of the shot and the kind of the session come about that then becomes the first album, which is kind of Space Oddity?
Well, it came. It was directly from the pictures I did of him in the arts lab when I showed them to David. He asked me if I'd take them around to Mercury Records and show them to Calvin Marklee, who is the AR man.
Yes.
So I did that, and Calvin's a really nice guy. We hit it off really well. He loved the pictures. And, you know, we became good friends, and it's after that, not long after that, maybe a month or so at the most, that David asked me if I'd talk to Calvin about doing the cover for his LP.
Yes.
And
the future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I think I met David at Calvin's office to discuss it. And Calvin collected Vasarely prints, you know, the op artist, and he had about a dozen of these in his office. And David quite liked the idea of using one as a background. Now I thought it wouldn't work if he was just standing in front of it. I thought, you know, that just doesn't look modern, doesn't look with it.
Yes.
So I suggested we try and do a shot with him emerging from the background, which is what eventually we did. It was a rather complicated procedure in those days, so there was no Photoshop, of course, so it had to become done mechanically by some quite skilled retouchers.
Yes. God, that's amazing, actually. And did you, with that particular session, were you sort of at that time just kind of working on your own? You didn't have a team of assistants around you?
Oh, no. I had an assistant, a Chinese guy called Xin. So there was just myself, Xin, Calvin and David at the session. So,
right.
It was, you know, the best way to work, fewest people as possible. And David, of course, very relaxed, a born poser. He loved posing.
Yes. Well, I must admit, over the decades, I've realized that he had so many sessions with so many photographers.
Mm.
There has been no other person quite like him. So, you know, I mean, I think we've almost got to the end, but we probably haven't, of all the different people releasing and publishing their books of David Bowie yeah. pictures, because it's just like, how many people did you work with, David? You know, it's like, so even at that stage in the 60s, he loved the lens, didn't he?
Yeah, and a lot of stars, of course, they get a bit blasé about it, and they don't want to do pictures with so-and-so, they only do pictures with somebody else, so. But I think David was quite keen on getting his picture anywhere.
This is true. This is very true. So once that came out, you got the photo, then you how did you then construct the image for the album?
Well, I didn't do it myself. I photographed the album as is, you know, a straightforward picture of that. And then we went through all the pictures I'd done of all the portraits I'd done of David, picked out the one we thought was the best, and then I gave the two transparencies to the people who are actually going to do the merging.
Yes,
retouching company,
and they did it, and it's beautiful.
And it took them a few goes, but they did it in the end.
My God, that's incredible. And then is that the, I mean, what happens next? Because obviously, you know, things move on. Do you at that stage then sort of, who moves out of the house first out of the little group of you there?
Well, the lease came up at the end of 69. I think it was about September 69. So everybody had to move out. And this coincided with myself moving to Paris. I'd been trying to get to Paris for about 6 months, going there and back, trying to get work.
Yes.
And I decided when the lease was up that I might as well make the jump and go and live there sort of permanently,
yeah,
which is what I did.
Amazing. And then, so then with Paris, what how do you then develop the rest of your career at this stage?
Well, it was still more or less starting off fresh. Luckily, I had a few contacts over there. So, you know, I could use those. But no, it was very, very hard to start off with. I had very little work. You know, I had to build it up slowly. And, but at the same time, you know, of course, I lost contact with David then. So it's about the same time as he started becoming really well known.
Yes.
And traveling, disappearing. So, you know, we lost contact then. And he phoned me up in Paris when he was over there. We're doing recordings, I think. Shows, I'm not quite sure what, and but I didn't get the message. I was living in a hotel at the time, and this was in the era before mobile phones, of course. Yes. So all he could do is leave me a message in the hotel, which I didn't get back to until late. And by that time, he'd moved on somewhere else. And,
yes, because you have another picture. I don't know if this is from the same session, which is that piece. Is it conversation piece? Book cover, is that with David with his hand on his kind of chin looking at the camera?
No, that wouldn't be mine.
Right. So you just did that one session with him and that was it?
Yeah, that's right, the cover. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Yes, so then, sorry about that, got that mixed up, but then after Paris, do you then sort of, have you found your, once you sort of get established, is it kind of the world that is kind of advertising and kind of slightly more sort of glamour?
Yeah, mainly fashion in Paris. Yeah, mainly fashion until, and then eventually I married and we had a child. And at that stage, I think we both thought, you know, central Paris was not the sort of place we wanted to bring up a child, so we moved back to London at that stage.
Yes, and there you go. And then you stayed. I mean, did you ever kind of get tempted to do any more sort of working with musicians and bands and stuff like that, or was it something that just didn't sort of enter your radar at all?
Didn't really. Yeah, it wasn't really sort of my field, I thought. I did a couple of other covers, purely accidentally, because, you know, I knew somebody or somebody had found my details. But, yeah, that's about it.
Yes. And each decade often has a different sort of a narrative and a bit of a different quality. So that was the kind of the 70s. What was your sort of work in the 80s? Did you continue?
80s, back in London. That was more, moved more into the public relations and advertising field. There was, arriving back in London, it was basically like starting up again from scratch, no clients. So it was more or less going through the same routine I had sort of 10 years ago in Paris, you know, finding the clients and also finding out what was the most reliable and best source of income. Because, you know, when you have a wife, family, yeah, that's rather important. So my sort of, I moved away from fashion completely, much more into advertising and PR.
Right. And I guess this was kind of really not the birth, but there was a kind of a massive explosion during the sort of 80s and 90s and then the internet. Did that play a massive part in your sort of world and career at that stage, the world of dial-up?
Well, yeah, I mean, that came quite late. The internet, I suppose, was around about 95, was it? 95, 2000, something?
Yeah, that was where we suddenly got dial-up and we had to sort of phone
right.
in and get very worried about being on the phone for 5 minutes,
yeah,
send an email.
And of course, that's when digital photography came in as well.
Yes.
And that changed an awful lot. That changed the business hugely, because a lot of clients started doing their own photography or employing people who are not highly qualified,
but yes,
because it's a lot easier to do digital photography than traditional film photography. Of course, you get the results straight away. And this is what the clients wanted. They wanted to see the results straight away. They didn't want to hang around for 3-4 hours at the best before they saw the result. So that did change an awful lot.
Yes. And did you manage to sort of keep working up till retirement, or did you manage to somehow sort of find a way to retire before, I don't know, 65?
No, I don't really consider myself retired yet.
This is the joy of being a photographer, I guess, isn't
but
it?
But I think you have to. Well, something I didn't realise, but I think a lot of people don't realise until it's too late. But as a photographer, you have a shelf life, really, because there reaches a stage where the actual clients themselves, either they die or they're promoted to a position where they're no longer commissioning photography. So, you know, you can hold a client for 10 years or 20 years. I've had a client, and in the end, they've retired.
Yes.
So you have to stay fairly flexible, I think. And
I guess you have to be a real hustler, don't you?
Well, I don't know. I've never looked at myself. Well, I looked upon myself as a hustler, but
I've
survived more by good luck than by hustling, I think.
Right. Yes, good luck and charm, I guess. I mean, when you, did you ever hear from David again, sort of in later life, apart from that one time when?
No, not after Paris. No, not at all.
Yeah, because it was interesting, because I know he seemed towards the latter part of his life, he seemed to be making little gestures towards people that he knew during his kind of early years. And he had he did a video, didn't he? And he had a reference to that film that Hermione went into about Norway. I can't now quite remember the title.
Oh, yeah.
But he wore this T-shirt, and it had this, because she then goes to do this film, doesn't she? And leaves him brokenhearted. And then in a video, he's wearing this T-shirt with the name of that film on. So it was like quite a nice little bit. And I know quite a few people who got emails just before he died, just to say, you know, we did some good work and stuff like that. So I just wondered if he'd kind of came out and mentioned anything to you. Did you ever meet Angie Bowie at all? Was Angie?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I knew Angie, yeah.
Oh, right. When did
I liked Angie quite a lot, actually. I thought she was really nice, and she was very good for David, I thought.
Yeah.
What happened to David wrong, I don't know.
Well, she did sort of like inject quite a lot into his career at this stage. So did you meet, was he still with Hermione when, when Angie appeared? Because I know I did an interview with Angie quite a few years ago, and she mentioned, I think she mentions Kelvin, you know, she in, you know, Mercury Records, because I think he's one of the people that she spoke to about, I don't know, getting David signed at that stage. So I think she was quite instrumental in some of those kind of early business deals, wasn't she?
Hermione, you mean?
No, Angie.
Angie, I imagine she is. I don't have any definite information on that, but, you know, I would imagine she would be very, very involved. Yeah, she wouldn't be sitting back and not saying anything.
No, I wouldn't imagine. And did you meet Ken Pitt at this stage as well? Was he?
No, I never did. No, no, I heard a lot about him. Calvin, of course, detested Ken Pitt because Calvin really wanted to manage. Managed David, but of course David was managed by Ken Pitt, but Calvin would really like to get him out of the way.
Yes. So with that Mercury album, that was his kind of the first album he did on the label, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it was Angie who had sort of managed to negotiate the deal. So
I wouldn't be too sure about that. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I'm not sure of the times, which the time scale, but I had an impression there that the Mercury deal might have gone through before
Angie was on the scene.
But I'm not sure.
Yeah. And what about Tony DeFries? Had he appeared at that stage?
No, I didn't know him at all.
It was just a world of it was just kind of a fascinating, you know, I suppose that few years between when you met David and Hermione and then Angie and then the next bit with, you know, Space Oddity and then obviously, you know, Ziggy, everything changed so much. Did you actually enjoy or like the album of the with your cover on? Was that sort of a record that you...
Yeah, no, I loved it. Of course, David gave me one and, you know, I used to play it a lot. I thought it was really good. I loved most of the songs, I think, were really good.
Yes, I know. It's a little bit of a classic. Did you go to the exhibition at the V&A, David Bowie?
I missed that. I can't think how I missed it, but I missed it.
Because it must be strange. I mean, if you could have...
But I believe they're going to do, the V&A are going to do a dedicated museum to him now, so I won't miss that.
Oh, God, that's right. That was just announced last week, wasn't it?
Yeah.
There you go. So are the negatives of that session, are they owned and in a cupboard somewhere with Mercury or somebody else?
Well, no, they're with the Bowie Archive. And the story about that is that about 10, 15 years ago, I started wondering what had become of them because as we were shooting on Transparency Film, everything went to the client. You know, I was left with absolutely nothing after the shoot. So I was thinking, well, you know, I'd really love to see those pictures again and it'd be great to get them scanned. So I was asking around all over the place. I tried all the record companies David had worked for, Mercury, Parlophone, Philips, all the others, and he's worked for quite a few. Nobody seemed to know where they'd gone. But then somebody suggested I phone up a lady in the Bowie Archives. I forget her name. But I sent her an email and just explained that I was the photographer and I'd be interested to see if by any chance they knew where the transparencies were. And I got an email back almost by return saying, yes, we've got them, all of them. So I said, oh, can I have a copy? And she said, yes, of course. And they sent me beautiful high-res files of the whole session.
Wow, that must have been a nice surprise. And how many pictures were there of that session?
Well, it was two, as far as I recall it. It was just two rolls. So that would be 24 pictures.
Right.
And then you add on the actual transparency that we made for the record cover.
Yes. So who on that level then owns the rights to the picture? Is it the client or do you still have any kind of copyright to it?
No, the copyright is mine, absolutely.
Right.
But the ownership, strangely enough, is now the archives.
Yes. The archives. Oh, that's good. You must be quite pleased. So was it the case that you didn't particularly use that image to sort of sell, but now you can, or were you able to get a reproduction and sell it via yourself?
Well, now I have the files. I can do what I like with them. So I've been marketing limited edition prints of one or two of them.
Yes.
It's been going very well.
I would imagine, actually, with people, collectors of this world. No. So for those who might be interested, where can you, do you have your own website? Is this on your own website?
Yeah, there are some, not all of them on my website. The simplest way is probably via direct email. You know, you can just type my name in Google and you'll find my contact details. Or there's a gallery called Snap Galleries.
Yes.
Which is in the Midlands, and they specialise in pop photography, and they're marketing it as well.
Fantastic! And you can get a signed one as well, which is even more amazing. Actually,
yeah,
that's really good. And so, I mean, if you were able to sort of whisper to your like 16-year-old self, kind of starting out in the creative, you know, industry that you went for, is there anything in particular you might have said, oh, that would have been a good idea, or that would have been a good thing to have focused on?
Become a rock star. No, seriously, I don't think I would have changed anything. Because, I can't complain. You know, no. I think I've had a good life, and I don't think I need to change anything.
No, absolutely not. Well, I have to say, the you know, that session obviously has a massive extra bit to your life, doesn't it, really?
I guess, really. Quite a trivial event at the time. And even afterwards, you know, I never thought much about it. But over the years, it's sort of grown in, and particularly since, strangely enough, since David's died, it seems to have become even more important and interesting.
And I guess with the V&A exhibition that happened a few years ago, and then this other exhibition that's going to be a permanent fixture. It's the sort of interest in all these narratives and stories just become bigger and bigger, don't they? Really.
So, and the image, of course, has been used all over the world. In the Pompidou Gallery, had it blown up to 3 meters square for an exhibition there. And same with the Vancouver Gallery of Art. They did the same, a huge enlargement of it. And another gallery in Italy also made a huge enlargement of it. So, you know, it's become sort of quite iconic.
Yes. Well, I guess this is the beginning of that. The 60s is one thing, his work, but this is the beginning of his kind of the 70s and then kind of onwards, really, isn't it? So, yeah, there you go. And did you manage to get to see David play live at all during that period, or just hear him strumming away in his living room?
I saw him at the Festival Hall, South Bank, when he had a concert there. And that was, that would have been 68, I think.
Right.
Somewhere around there, yeah. He played with another group. I'm not sure who they were. Small Faces or somebody like that. I can't remember.
Yeah. Was Tony Visconti around at that stage? And
he was. He played the same. He played with David. Because I remember David introduced him as the world's greatest bass guitarist. I didn't know he was playing bass guitar, but apparently.
Yes. So I guess at that stage, there might have been John Cambridge might have been about, who was the drummer. But probably not Mick Ronson. Had Mick Ronson appeared at that stage?
I have a feeling not. I'm not absolutely sure about that.
No.
I think I'd remember if he had. But
Yes, that blonde hair. Did it feel, yeah. I mean, you might have been in Paris, but I just, a few years later, you know, he appears on Top of the Pops singing Starman. Did you sort
I
of...
Saw that. Yeah, I've seen recordings of that, yeah.
You must have been like, oh, the hairstyle's changed a bit.
Everything changed, yes.
Yes.
They're not remember the same person. the little guy from upstairs. But David, I have the fondest memories of David because he was a really nice guy, tremendous sense of humour, always laughing, always joking, didn't take himself at all seriously, which is quite strange for him in that sort of milieu.
Yes, absolutely.
Take themselves seriously.
And obviously Hermione is still around. Was she also a sort of equally nice person?
Yeah, I didn't have a lot to do with Hermione. Didn't see her all that much, but she seemed to be a very nice girl. Yeah.
Did you ever? I know probably that concert you saw with Tony Visconti was when they were in the band called Hype, where I think they slightly dressed up. It might not have been completely the same concert, but I remember they did one concert together or gig, and it was so. Did you ever see David performing acoustically, you know, live, or was it just in his kind of living room that you just saw him strumming away?
I think he was playing acoustic in the concert in the Festival Hall, at least the one he did. The one track he did, Jack Brel's In the Port of Amsterdam, which I thought was completely out of context for him, but I'm pretty sure he was playing acoustic guitar on that. I'm not sure.
Yes. And when was the first time you heard Space Oddity?
Up in his room when he was just finished writing it. And he had his little stylophone there, which I thought at first was a joke. I thought, you can't be serious, you're not using that. Something out of a Christmas cracker, you know, made this awful noise.
Yes, I know.
when you hear it in context, you know, on the actual track, it's perfect.
Yes, at that stage, I guess the kind of the moon landing was such a monumental moment, wasn't it?
It was all space at the time. It was very, very space orientated.
I would imagine, you know, the excitement of what's going to happen next was just amazing. Then we had the 70s and the 3-day week, so yeah. Never mind. It was a little bit of a grubby decade at times with great music. But look, thank you ever so much for your time. This has been amazing. If you want, I can always send you a copy of the interview. And then I don't know if you've got any place, space that you can put it. I think you've got a Facebook page, haven't you?
I've got a Facebook page and an Instagram page. And I could stick it up on that by all means.
That would be magic. Well, look, thank you again for your time. This has been amazing. And
pleasure.
Yes, take care. And thanks again. And amazing art.
Give me the link and I'll put you up.
I will. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
No, bye.
And that, dear listener, was the end of the interview. I'm sure you gathered that. Anyway, a massive thank you to Vernon Dewhurst for giving me the time for that interview. And I will put some links of how you can find his work and purchase bits and pieces as well. Aren't you lucky? Anyway, this has been the C86 Show. I'm David Eastall. If you want to contact me, you can on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just do C86 Show. All these have been archived, interviews that is. So you can find those on Spotify, iTunes, Podbean. It's true. Anyway, have a great week. Stay safe.